Okay, so, guys, so a few years ago, when I was still in Toronto, so one of the things that I had to do was when the shul that I was placed in, the bayit, had series of shirim, so. Sometimes I gave their winter Beit Midrash series, but one year they decided to have a rotation of all the rabbis on staff. I decided every rabbi had to be part of it, and the theme was Torah in the movies, I think, which was not exactly the easiest thing in the world for me to give. And this year originally emerged from that series. It's really a more relaxed way of doing a deep dive into Sefer Shmuel. So, guys know that I really do like learning Tanakh and making sure you guys know Tanakh. So that's what we're going to do, is we're going to do this in a bit more of a relaxed way. I know life has been crazy, so, you know, doing a bit of a different type of shir is probably good for all of us. If you haven't watched Lord of the Rings, I'm sorry. But I encourage you to do it at some point. You can understand the shir without, but really, you really should watch it. It's really good. You should read them also. Whatever. Okay. So, but as I said, what we're going to try to do Toch Kedei is a deep dive into Sefer Shmuel. Okay? Now, the reason I think it's helpful to do it in this sort of unorthodox context is the following. Shmuel and Malachim, which really trace the monarchy of the Jewish people, right? Shmuel begins, let's see how much Tanakh you guys know. Shmuel begins with what? How does Shmuel start? Thank you, with Eli, right? Is that Sefer Shoftim had ended the very problematic period of the localized leaders known as the Shoftim. Very, very problematic. What? Most of the Shoftim are not national leaders, as far as we can tell, right? This is an important point, guys. If you don't realize this, you will probably misunderstand Sefer Shoftim. But the simple shot of Sefer Shoftim is that most of the leaders are not national. Okay? Yiftach is on Eiver HaYarden, right? He lives he's part of Shevet Menashe, and one of his major battles is with Ephraim, who come over from the other side to challenge him for not bringing them into the fight against Ammon. And he murders them, 42,000 of them, on the bridge on the way back into Israel. Well, he's not even Israel. He's a localized leader in Eiver HaYarden. Shimshon is from Dan. Seems to have some influence in Yehuda. Most of the Shoftim are localized. Yeah. Well, first of all, they're not all divinely ordained.
Okay.
That's just wrong.
Warlords.
Only the first 9 prakim explicitly say God chooses them. Starting at Perek Yud, it never said God chooses them again. Yiftach isn't chosen by God. He's chosen by Anshe Yavish Gilad. He's retroactively sanctioned, maybe, by God, but not chosen. Shimshon is a bit of an outlier there. How does Sefer Shoftim end? Very good. With three disastrous stories, the mantra of which is repeated many times, I think 8 times in the prakim, is that all of this happened in Israel. Ki ein, right at that time, ein melech b'Yisrael v'yishe yashar b'einav yaseh. At that time, there was no king, and everyone did whatever they wanted. Right. So the three closing stories of that nightmare of a book are: I'm learning them now with my son, and wow, is it hard to teach these? Right. I'm about to get to the worst one, and I really don't know what I'm going to do. I'm sort of stalling. Right, the Shimshon stories, which are problematic, but then you have Pesel Micha, right, the disastrous story of Pesel Micha, where Micha builds a Beit Avodah Zarah, hires, after stealing money from his mother, and then uses the money to build the Avodah Zarah. His mother, after offering it to return, his mother said, no, keep the money, make an idol. Great. And then he hires a Levi to be his Kohen, and then Mishpachat Dan come and in their quest to invade new land and massacre the people in Sidon, also steal the Kohen and the entire all the idols in the house. And you're not really sure by the end who's a good guy. The answer is nobody. And then Pilagish Begiva, which is, you know, the nightmare of all stories of Tanakh, which is the vicious gang rape that happens in the city of the Binyamin city of Giv'ah. And right, the Pilagish of this Levi is raped, and when left for dead, her husband takes her body, cuts it up into multiple pieces, sends it to Klal Yisrael, who then wage a civil war against Binyamin when Binyamin refuses to bring him to justice and bring the people to justice. They lose the first few times and lose many, many, many people, and then in the final battle, kill everybody in Binyamin, bar a few hundred, and then in order to make sure they are married, they go to the Anshe Yavesh Gilad and steal women and kidnap them to marry the remaining people of Binyamin after they kill the men. It's really not a... And Tanakh summarizes that the problem of this whole thing is that there was no king. Okay? Fine. Shmuel opens up. And you begin with the story of Eli. Okay? Who's Eli? A Kohen. And he also seems to be a leader. The problem in the time of Eli is, what's the state of society? Not great. What's the state of the Mikdash? Even worse. Of the Mishkan, rather. That's not what I meant. What's not so great about it? What? Very good, his sons. His sons are disasters. The sons, Chafni and Pinchas, according to Pshat, when women come to the Beit HaMikdash, they commit adultery with them. Chazal understand it slightly differently, but that's how the Nach presents it. Very differently, I should say. In the meantime, there's a woman named Chana who's married to a guy named Elkanah who has a problem. What's her problem? She doesn't have kids. Bigger problem. Not only does she not have kids, but her co-wife, Penina, has many kids. Chana is not happy about this. Penina makes fun of her constantly. And every year, the whole family goes up to the Mishkan. They bring people with them, bring Karbanot. One year, it's just too much for Chana. She's upset. And her husband says, I don't understand the problem. I'm here for you. What do you need kids for? Gevalt. That makes things worse. Now, at that moment, when she realizes she's totally alone, because even her beloved husband doesn't really get it, what does she do? She goes to the Mishkan, she cries her eyes out, she davens soundlessly, right? Her lips move, and what does Eli, who's supposed to be this religious hero, do? Yes, instead of comforting her, he says, you drunkard, how long will you be drunk? And she says, I'm not drunk, I'm sad. You know the difference? Right? There's a difference between these two phenomena. He apologizes. He doesn't actually apologize. He blesses her. Says, whatever you want, God will give you. She goes back happy. She has a child. And she promises that the child that she has will be dedicated to the Mikdash. The child she has is Shmuel. Until he's weaned, she keeps him home. She doesn't go back to the Mishkan. Once he's weaned, she makes a special jacket for him, vest, whatever, brings him to the Mishkan. And what? At the ripe age of two. Right, brings him to work in the Mishkan forever. Visits him, you know, I guess periodically. Brings new jackets for him. And eventually he gets his first nevuah, right? In a wonderful scene where he hears voices while he's sleeping. He keeps going to Eli and says, Eli, you called me. Eli said, no, I didn't call you. She goes back to sleep. It happens again. And finally, Eli realizes it's going to be a nevuah. So Shmuel gets a nevuah. What's his nevuah?
Gloom and destruction for the
house. Yeah, Eli's house, family is going to be destroyed because he didn't stop them from all their immoral acts. And Eli comes and says, tell me what you said. Otherwise, I know God told you something, you have to tell me or I'll curse you. So he tells him what happened. And V'kachava, right, this is what happens. The Jews go to war, they take out the Aron, it's a whole disastrous story, to try to win the battle. They lose the Aron, and when they come back to, and Chafi and Pinchas are both killed, and they come to tell Eli, the fact that his sons get killed doesn't impress him so much. When he's heard the Aron is taken, he falls backwards, hits his head and dies. Right? And at that time, he has a grandchild, right? And because of the terrible situation, the mother of the child names the child Ikavod, right? Or in English, Ichabod. Right? Lack of honor because of the terrible situation her family's in. Right? This is the opening to the book of Shmuel.
And then happens that beautiful world wise to be shown.
That is the opening of Sefer Shmuel. Okay? Now, here's the... Right? Then you get the whole saga of Shmuel. Right? Where Shmuel rises to power, and everyone recognizes him as a super Navi. And eventually the Jews demand a king. And Shmuel is not happy. What do you need a king? You're rejecting God. And God says this amazing thing to Shmuel, which is... Why are you taking this personally? It's not you they hate, it's me. Let them have a king. Right. Fine. I know this is not such a bad thing to hate God, apparently. He lets them have a king. And you get the appointment of Shaul, which happens in stages, right? Shaul loses his father's animals. He goes searching. He finds Shmuel. Shmuel anoints him, and eventually he becomes king. And the people don't accept him, but then he wins a battle, so they accept him. And then there are multiple battles. And where's Avi? Right? He's winning battles. And by his first major battle, after everyone accepts him, he's already not listening. He's told, wait until Shmuel comes. Wait 7 days before you start fighting. He doesn't listen. He starts bringing Garban out. He tries to defend himself. And Shmuel already tells him, by that point, you're not going to be king. Right? And things only go downhill from there. Right? And eventually it goes so downhill, you get David. Okay? And the rest of Sefer Shmuel, basically, from this point on, is the saga of Shaul to David, and then the saga of David. Right? David dies at the beginning of Malachim. Right, so the story of Shmuel, right? Shmuel Aleph and Bet are really just one book, the Sefer Shmuel. It's the story, the rise and fall of Shaul, and the very, very brief tenure of his son Ishbosheth as king. Very, very short. What?
Ishbosheth was his son.
Yes. He had other sons. More famously, is Yonatan, but Yonatan is never king. Ishbosheth is king temporarily. And then you have the saga of David, David's successes, David's failures, his sins, David and Bathsheba, all of his punishments, the rebellion of Avshalom, all types of fun stuff. And Malachim opens with David's death scene after the attempted usurping of the throne by his son Adoniyahu, second rebellion, and then Shlomo, and then Malachim tells the story of Malchut Yehuda and Malchut Israel. What I want to focus on today is mostly Sefer Shmuel. Here's the thing about Shmuel, okay? Shmuel and Malachim in general. Shmuel, I think, even maybe more than Malachim. I don't think most people understand Sefer Shmuel at all. And I don't just mean they haven't read it or read it well. Naniach. Unfortunately. How many people, by the way, are even vaguely familiar with the story of Shmuel? Most of this sounded vaguely familiar? Okay, good. So Shmuel I think there are a lot of fundamental problems that people don't understand about the book. Because they're so far into our experience. It's a book fundamentally of, you know, ancient kings and the rebellions that happened, the court intrigue. There's also this very weird dynamic that I don't think people quite wrap their head around between the Navi and the Melech. I also think that for a lot of modern people, to understand the drama and the glory of the battles is hard. Right? I think a lot of people grew up basically saying, what do they know about David? That he couldn't build the Beit HaMikdash because he had blood on his hands. Right? Which, for the record, where does it say that in Tanakh? Well, let's be precise. It does say it in Divrei Yamim. Does God ever say that?
No.
Never happens. God never actually says that about David. Who says it? David says it. David claims that's the reason that God didn't let him build the Beit HaMikdash. Except, why, according to God, why didn't David build the Beit HaMikdash? What? He did. According to God, when David asked him, can I build the Beit HaMikdash, God says, sure, just not yet. Your son will build it. Now, we take that as a no, but Hashem presents it as a yes, meaning, you will. It's not you personally, but it'll be your malchut. It'll be your dynasty that'll be responsible for it. It's fundamentally a yes. Because if you notice, what happens after God gives his no that everyone thinks is a no? What does David do? And he bursts into song and he thanks God. Right? That's not the no. Right? It's clearly a yes, but. Right? A not yet, not a no. Right? There's nothing wrong with David. But we grow up with this because, I think especially, not in Israel, where military service is not something we do. Right, that type of message resonates a lot. And to remember that much of David's greatness wasn't despite the fact that he was a warrior. What was because he was a warrior, we have a trouble identifying with. But it's undeniably the case that part of his greatness is that he's a warrior. And Shaul also. Right, meaning Shaul... Avi, let's help us. What's special about Shaul? How does the Torah, the Navi describe? Why is Shaul so kingly?
His appearance?
Yeah, he's tall and good-looking, right? He's tall, good-looking. He's a strapping young man, a good warrior. Right? That's what he is. And I do find that people don't quite get it. Even if they've read it, they don't really think about what's happening in the story. And what I found at some point is that if you watch it in a movie, not a movie about Shmuel, but you watch, in this particular case, I use Lord of the Rings because I like Lord of the Rings a lot. I don't make it, no secret about that. I was very happy last night that I had a back and forth with a dear friend of mine who is both a tremendous Talmud Chacham. He's Rosh Kolel, Skan Rosh Kolel, or something of the YU Kolel in Chicago. And also is quite familiar with The Lord of the Rings and had a long discussion last night to add some points to it, where he both knew the ins and outs of the Silmarillion, Lord of the Rings, and the difference between the movies and it, and also is a Torah and Zalman Chacham, so he could add to both conversations. I'm glad I have friends like that. You should get yourself friends like that, I'm just saying.
So basically you're asking us to befriend you?
Or find friends who are very good at Torah and also are broader. Rabbi Noah Goldstein. And we were talking about it, and I think it really is an effective way. And what I'm going to try to do today is do a deep dive into Shmuel and lighten the mood by showing you why I think that it really does help visualize it. If we use, in this case, the movie, and I will not, for the purpose of this year, be a purist. As I mentioned to Sean before, Lord of the Rings, I approve of both the book and the movie, and therefore I don't need to be a purist on the book. I think there are differences between the book and the movie that are significant, but I like both, and I'm willing to utilize both. It's not true of other, that's not true of all movies. Some movies I will not use because the books are so much better. But Lord of the Rings, I hold of both. Right, they're both. And I want to try to do a deep dive into Shmuel in a bit of out of the box way. Okay, but let me start with the following introduction. If you look at the first source I gave you, for those of you who have the sources, they're around. It's two pages. This is a letter from Tolkien. Okay, now, first thing you got to know about Tolkien. Tolkien, J.R.R. Tolkien, in addition to being a prolific author, what? Is a very religious personality, and the other personality that he runs, one of the other personalities he runs with in his circle is C.S. Lewis. Right? Now, both of them are deeply, deeply religious and come up with beautiful reflections on Tanakh in different ways. The Silmarillion, which is the Hakdama to the Hakdama of Lord of the Rings, before the Hobbit. It's like the Breishit of the Hobbit. Right? Literally, it's the creation of the world. It's very biblical, with, you know, magic trees and things like that. For another time, C.S. Lewis wrote a sci-fi perush on Breishit.
Are you talking about
Pshuto Kimashmo? It is an entire book, which is a sci-fi imagination of if Breishit happened again on Venus, and Adam and Chava didn't sin. It's called Perelandra. Fascinating, fascinating book. Very weird. Also fascinating. And as one of my teachers once pointed out, almost the same perush in the original sin as the Nativ. So do that what you will. But he's deeply religious. And he has this fascinating comment in letter 142 where he writes, "The Lord of the Rings is, of course, a fundamentally religious and Catholic work. Unconsciously so at first, but consciously in the revision. That is why I have not put in or have cut out practically all references to anything like religion, to cults or practices in the imaginary world. For the religious element is absorbed into the story and the symbolism." Whereas he has this fascinating comment that the book wasn't originally a religious mashal. This is not C.S. Lewis's Narnia. Right? Narnia is one big Christian mashal. Right? I remember I said this to someone once and they're like, "What? Where do you see Christian imagery?" I'm like, literally everywhere. But I was like, do you really need more than the son of God, essentially, who dies for the son of Adam and is resurrected on the stone table, or the end of the seventh book, where Aslan meets you with Father Time as you go from Narnia to the Narnia to come. I'm like, honestly, what did you miss in these seven books? Like, honestly, it's not like he hit it very well. Tolkien didn't do that. Right? Tolkien did not do that. It wasn't explicitly religious, right? He says he originally wrote this because he really liked mythology, and he realized that British people don't have good myths. And that bothered him. So he decided to write it, right? And he did. Right, he wrote The Lord of the Ring. The Silmarillion is the background myths. And then, you know, there's all the languages he wrote with full dictionaries of many, many languages that exist in Middle-earth. Which is, you know, because his background's also in linguistics. But he claimed, as I said here later in his life, that he didn't mean for The Lord of the Rings to be a religious metaphor. But it obviously is, meaning it's obviously written by someone who is very familiar with Tanakh, and in many ways it really is just a fantasy version of a lot of themes in Tanakh. And, you know, I just note that Tolkien was also by profession one of the things he did is he translated parts of the Bible, like professionally. He translated Sefer Yonah. He did a lot of things, yes. What? I think from Hebrew. I don't know. You can look it up. I gave you the reference, okay? And so as we go through, what I want to do is try to go through some central themes in Shmuel, and Povisham will watch some clips to try to illustrate these things in a way that I don't know if you've thought about before, but hopefully we'll give you a better idea into the book. Okay? Here's the first point I want to make. Okay, now that we've introduced you to the book of Shmuel. Okay, that was about a half-hour introduction to the book of Shmuel. And we didn't get through much of it, but it's an introduction. The first point is the following. If I asked you, what is a Navi? Don't look down. What is a Navi? Tell me.
He's a speaker to the people. Like, he speaks in mass to the people.
Okay, speaks to the people. Great. What's his role? What does he do? Speaks. What does he do? What does he speak about?
He transmits messages from God.
So one role is he communicates with the vine. That's for sure. Name me a Navi whose identity primarily comes from communication to the vine.
Yirmiyahu?
Okay, sometimes. Give me the example. Moshe, thank you. Right? That's literally what Moshe does. Okay? Moshe does a lot of stuff. Good. What else? Moshe is... But that's one role of a Navi. What else does Navi do? Yeah? Adam. Good. He is a... Right? He gives Musar. Right? He gives Musar. He encourages people. He rebukes people. Good. What else does he do? When you think of Navi, what is a Navi? Someone said, Bluth said, Moshe did a lot of things. Okay, what else is Moshe? He's a different model of Navi. What else is he?
He's also a
leader. What else is he? He's a lawgiver. I would think that would be pretty up there on Moshe's list. He's a lawgiver.
Was that really a Navi thing or Moshe?
What else is he? What else?
Well,
for most Navim, but Moshe is. Right? He's still a Navi. He's still a Navi. No, it has a Navi. It clearly is a Navi. It's the uniqueness of his Nevuah, but it still is him as a Navi. That's the uniqueness of his Nevuah. What else? What else is a Navi? What? Okay, sometimes, yeah. Defends the people to God. What else? Yeah.
One of the holy men who occasionally will stand up to his world power.
Good. Okay, we're going to come back to that, right? He's a corrective force to the monarchy, yeah? Shua. Shua. Okay, I said I'll come back to it. Shua, yeah. Please don't interrupt Shua. 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 Yosef. Shua. Yeah, right. Let me say, he checks the king. So, I gave you here an article by Ray Yitzchak Etchalom where he notes that if you think about Navi, right? By the way, before I ask that question, have any of you ever sat down and actually think, what is the role of Navi in Tanakh?
We had a shiur from Rabbi Ginsburg where he asked us straight out, what is a Navi?
Okay. So Rabbi Etchalom notes in his introduction to his series on Nevi'im that he outlines 8 different types, roles that the Navi plays. Now, some Nevi'im play more than one role, okay? Obviously, number one, Nevi'im had the role of communicating with the divine, right? Fine. Some Nevi'im, their main role is not communicating with divine, but is representing the divine message. The example he gives of this type of Navi is Avram. Avram clearly talks to God, but that's not his main role as Navi. His main role as Navi is the bearer of God's message. The third is God's messenger to the people. Not just talking to the divine, but conveying God's message to the people, like Moshe. Lawgiver, mostly Moshe, though some later Nevi'im have laws, maybe not permanent laws, but laws. We'll skip E for a minute. There's the charismatic Navi, whose main job is to inspire people, criticize them, like Eliyahu, Elisha. Then there is the independent critical Navi, right, who stands as a check on power, like Yirmiyahu, Yeshayahu, And then there are certain people who are what he calls the people's prophet, that most of their goal is to encourage people. They're nice. Nice, Nevi'im. Not Amos. Amos is not nice at all. Amos has no nice moments. Well, maybe one. Maybe one. I don't understand. Where do you see in Amos that he's nice?
I was more thinking people's prophet.
People's prophet, where he says, I don't want to be here. I'm not a Navi. I'm not the son of a Navi. And you people are fat cows. Where did you get literal quote? Quote, and I'm a cowboy. Like, what? Where? He is actually a cowboy. That's actually what he says. Okay. But, there is one type of Navi that is most prominent in Shmuel and Malachim, both the true Nevi'im and the false Nevi'im. Yes, Yonatan.
What's the conveniency?
No. One is that he represents God to the people. The other is that he actually is a messenger of God's message to the people. Right? Those are different, right? Avram isn't sent to tell people anything. God tells him things, but he teaches people Derech Hashem. Right? He doesn't convey God's, like, it's not like God tells him something, he tells the people. Right? God talks to him, but he represents God. Right? As opposed to Moshe, whose primary goal is to actually act as God's messenger. But what the main type of Navi that we find, guys, the main type of Navi that we find in Shmuel Malachim, both the true Nevi'im and the false Nevi'im, are court prophets. Okay? What's a court prophet?
They signed a chill with the king. They advise the king.
That is really a bad description. Chill with the king. They don't chill with the king. What do they do?
Tell them that everything he's doing is okay.
No. No.
Yeah,
no. Yes. But what is the role of a court prophet?
Like, speak as the best advisor possible.
He's an advisor to the king. Very good. He's part of the cabinet.
Advisor.
He's part of the cabinet. Right? He's part of the cabinet. He's part of the government. Okay? Now, wait. It is true that the false Nevi'im, right, rubber stamp whatever the king says. Right? That's what the false Nevi'im do. But they're clearly there to act as advisors and to add legitimacy to the government. That's what they do. Right? And you'll get this later on in Malachim. So, for example, why is it so important for Izebel to kill out the Nevi'i Hashem and to have her own hundreds of Nevi'i HaBaal and Nevi'i HaSherah, which are Olchei Shulchan HaMelech, who eat at the king's table? Because they're part of the court. They add legitimacy to a world which is infused with religion. To have the Navi there as an advisor grants legitimacy. Now, the false Nevi'im do that entirely by rubber stamping everything the king says. But the true Nevi'im do this as well. In cases where the king is right, they add legitimacy and they strengthen his position. And in cases where he's wrong, what do? They challenge him. Because their role is, they're integrated into the political system. That role of Navi is most explicit in Shmuel and Melachim. So look at Rabbi Yechalim's summary, and then let's talk about how this plays out. It might be argued that Shmuel ranks as the second most empowered prophet after Moshe. He's being listed with Moshe in Yirmiyahu 15:1. And poetically in Tehillim 99:6 with Moshe and Aaron. Someone quote me that pasuk. Thank you. Moshe Aaron b'chohanav u'shmuel b'karei shemo. Thank you. Although it may be a bit premature to call him a court prophet, Shmuel is the first whose mission involves anointment of kings and whose destiny is to be the vehicle of change from prophetic dynamic leadership to monarchic dynastic government. Although Shmuel never serves formally in anyone's court, he acts as Shaul's assumed superior, chastising him for violating God's word, and twice announcing Shaul's demotion. First from the father of a dynasty, and then famously stripping him of the monarchy. He also serves in one famous scene as a sort of prophet for David when the latter flees to Ramah to seek Shmuel's protection from Shaul. David, however, is the first to have court prophets, and these prove to be the last true prophets who serve in a court. Gad, the seer, meaning Gad HaChozeh, joins David early in his flight from Shaul, and Natan remains with him and in the royal court after David's death. Their job seems to be to keep the king in check and ensure that he's acting according to God's directive and not allowing the excesses and power of the office to sway him from obedience to God. A definition is in order. By court prophet, I mean someone who is employed by the court, whose job is to be an advisor to the king and to borrow the biblical parlance, eats at the king's table. For purposes of our categorization scheme, we will only include those court prophets who were from the perspective of the text proper and true prophets. The only possible candidate for court prophet subsequent to Natan might be Shemaiah, who was sent by God to restrain Rehavam from attacking the northern tribes after the tax rebellion at the court of the succession. After that point, the court prophets all appear to be royal lackeys who simply declare in the name of prophecy what the king wants to hear. A clear example of this is the dichotomy between the court prophets and Michayahu ben Yimla in Melachim Aleph Perek Chaf. In other words, the court prophets are anything but Nevi'im. They serve not the divine word, but royal abuses and corruption. Give me a second to finish my thought. So there is a category, which, as Rei Etchalom notes, pretty much only appears in Shmuel and Melachim. And that's why, if you don't stop to think about it, you forget this. But one of the roles of Nevi'im, again, mostly Shmuel, Gad, and Natan, are to be members of the royal court. They both add legitimacy to the king, and they act to rebuke the king when he's wrong. Most famous rebuking moment, of course, of is Natan to David after the Maaseh Batsheva, where he says, where he critiques him. But I do need to avert for a moment from what Rabbi Etchalom said, because Rabbi Etchalom makes the claim that it is clear that the court prophet, the real court prophets, are above the king. That's not 100% true. Because it's true, in a certain sense, that the Nevi'im are seen as prior and more powerful to the king. And that's why they can act as a check on the king. But that's only true as long as the kings grant them that power. If the kings don't grant them that power, then what happens?
They become independent prophets.
It becomes much more difficult, let's say. And Shmuel has this moment, right? As much as it's obvious that Shmuel is above the king, he's prior to the king, what happens? What does he say when God tells him, Shmuel, I want you to go and appoint a new king. I want you to appoint David. What does he say? First he says, I don't want to. But what is he, then what does he say when he agrees to go?
Like, I have such a good relationship
with him. No. After that, once he agrees to go, what does he say? I'm afraid. Shaul's going to kill me. And what does Hashem say to him?
Fear not.
No. He says, fake it. Bring a karbon and pretend you're going to bring a karbon.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Hide it. Which means that in theory, the role of the Navi is superior to that of the king. But only in theory. Right? Only in theory. That's if a king recognizes his place. But if he doesn't, then he, right? There's this complex relationship where the role of who's on top, the Navi or the king, is not totally clear. Right? And you have fights, even between righteous kings, right? Chizkiyahu and Yeshayahu are sometimes at odds. Right. Yoshio, right, goes to war. He's a tzaddik. He goes to war when he shouldn't against the advice of the king, gets killed in Megiddo. Right, even the righteous kings, their relationship with the Navi is fraught. But the role of the Navi in Shmuel, both the book and the person, is to be the mover and shaker of political movements, the creator of kings, the advisor to kings. He is responsible for politics. He's responsible for making sure the politics goes in the direction that God wants. That's his job. He's fundamentally a religious insert into the political process. That's what he is. Right? 100%, that's what he is. And let me explain to you how much this is true. Okay? Didn't forget that you have a question. But let me describe my theory of Shmuel. Okay? Shmuel, as far as I can tell, is a transition figure. He's not just a Navi. He's a transition between the world of the Shoftim to the world of kings. Because if I asked you, what is the difference between a shofet, a localized leader, and a king, what would you tell me?
Centralized.
One is centralized leadership. Very good.
Consistency of power.
Dynastic. Meaning dynastic. Good. What else?
Cannot go against.
Okay, good. So let's talk about the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. At the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, is there national leadership?
Ish.
Not ish. Is there national leadership?
No.
Yes, there is. Eli. There's one leader. He's the Kohen Gadol. Yes. When they want to go to war, where do they go? Who do they ask? And
he doesn't direct them.
He does sort of direct them.
They ask him for advice.
Okay. But there is a centralized, at least, authority. Maybe not a power broker quite yet. Right? What about Shmuel? Is Shmuel a national leader?
Pretty much serves as like a king.
He does. He does serve as a king. He's a national leader. Right? How else do I know he's a national? What else tells me that he's sort of king-like?
I think he won't choose the victory over Pleshtim.
Well, he's involved in wars, but more importantly, when does Shmuel reveal his hand? Twice. Once when he says to God, God, I don't want... Why should we appoint a king? And what does God say to him? What did I say he says to him? They're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. Which means, what did Shmuel think? Not that he was quite king, but that if there's a king, they're replacing for him. Meaning? Right, but why would he think that? Unless his role is a quasi-king, as a national political leader. Right? What's the second big clue? When else does Shmuel get really angry? When the Jews say, we don't want your sons to take over for you. Remember, one of the keys to kingship in Melachim is, in Shmuel Melachim is, dynasty. Shmuel thinks he deserves a dynasty. Right? And he doesn't. Right? The king comes because his children aren't worthy. So Shmuel, he's not a king, but he's definitely a bridge figure between the pure world of Shoftim, these localized leader, and a king who's a national king. Right? He's a national leader who expects a dynasty, which means he's already... It's not just he's the person who brings about kingship. What is he? He's a quasi-king himself. Right? And that's why he's a bridge figure. And it's not just that. He is a transition personality who his entire life is basically one step ahead of where the Jews need to be. consistently. Right? The Jews aren't ready for a king. The Jews want a king. What does Shmuel say? No. So what does God say? Give them a king. Later on, right? God says, I want to fire Shaul. And what does Shmuel say? Don't fire Shaul. Don't fire Shaul. And God says, quit crying about Shaul. Right? We're past him. And then he gets to appoint David, and he keeps picking the tall, handsome brothers. And at some point, what does God say to him? Stop looking at the exterior, look at the heart. But what is he really saying? Stop looking for people who look like Shaul. Right? You think we're still at Shaul, so you're looking for people who look like him. Tall and strong. That's not what the next scene looks like. He's always one step behind because, right, he's a transition figure. Now this, I think, for most people, when you really, really describe what's just there in pshat in the book, how many people, until I articulated this, really thought of what exactly the role of Shmuel was as Navi? How many people thought he was a quasi-king, right? A member of the cabinet, both subservient to the king and superior to the king at the same time? How many had thought about the fact that just in pshat, that is what Shmuel is? And we have trouble because we think of Nevi'im as people who say the word of God, right? We don't think of them as fundamentally politicians, right? We don't. So now, my first insight, for those of you who have watched the movies, okay? Okay? Consistently, right? What is the role of the wizard? Gandalf, usually. Right, in Lord of the Rings. What is his role? What?
Marshalling the team to war.
He's an advisor to the leader.
Well, let's talk about what did he do, right? What does he do?
He goes to the leader of Rohan.
So, he is, first of all, right, he is the person responsible for making sure that the wars that need to happen, happen, that the kings do what they're supposed to do. He goes to Rohan, right? He is the one who makes sure that the ring goes to where it needs to go. But what else is he doing? What's part of his job?
Make sure he coordinates Aragorn.
Very good. He's responsible to make sure that the Davidic king, which we'll get to, Aragorn, right, returns to his long-lost throne. Right? That's what he does. And he's clearly presented as a spiritual leader. Right? Clearly. Right? He represents truth. Right, he represents what's right. You have to listen to him. Right, you can't challenge. Right, you can't challenge Gandalf, and he's a scholar, a Talmud Chacham. Right, the student of ancient lore. Right, that's what he's presented as. Right.
He's also
now, but let me ask you. Okay. When you think of Shmuel, even now that I've told you he's a politician, he's a court prophet, his responsibility is to make sure that politics happen as they're supposed to. If I ask you, how many of you think of Shmuel as, even now that I've told it, in your head, you still have a picture of a rabbi?
I
hope we're getting rid of this. How many of you are thinking, how many of you are thinking warrior? How many of you think Navi as warrior? How many of you is that in your mind?
Possible.
Good. Someone tell me, is Shmuel a warrior?
Yes.
Yeah? Give me a good example.
When Shaul doesn't kill.
Very good. When Shaul doesn't do what he's supposed to and kill Agag, so what does he do?
He says, I'll take care of
it. He quarters the guy. He goes to Agag and he cuts him into four pieces. Right? This isn't the Rosh Yeshiva you know. Okay? Right? This is... Someone please tell me, imagine your eyes if you can imagine Reb Chaim Ozer in that position. Okay? Right? 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 Zelokacha. Okay? But, and here's where I think that movies are helpful. Okay? Because, when you read Tanakh, right? We've been talking about Shmuel almost for an hour now. Right? At least for me. You think about it and it's like, wait a second. Shmuel, he's a Navi. So I'm thinking someone who talks to God. It's true, he talks to God. But 90% of his job is politics, is making sure that things happen, the kings are coronated, that the political events happen that as they're supposed to make sure that wars against the ultimate evil happen, think about what he does. Right? Literally, his responsibility is to make sure that Shaul kills Amalek, which is the ultimate evil, kill every single one of them, and when they don't, he takes it literally into his own hands. He takes a sword and quarters the king. Okay? That is Shmuel. Okay? I think for most people, you read the book and you try to imagine like a spiritual leader who's also sort of king, but also coronates kings and is a warrior and somehow is both a spiritual figure but political and can be violent when necessary, but that's not contradictory to his personality, right? We're not so good at that. And then, what? I don't know. All I know is that when you think about what a Navi is in Shmuel and Malachim, right? I'm not talking Moshe, right? Moshe doesn't fight. Moshe sits and davens while Yeshua fights, right? That's not the type of Navi Moshe is, right? He fights by bringing Mako down from God. Fine, that's a Navi, right? But Shmuel is going around with a sword, right? He's killing people. That's what he does. He is God's hand in politics. Fine. He kills the Egyptian before he's a Navi, first of all. Right? 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 And we never know. First of all, in the process of saving someone. And second of all, he never kills anyone once he's a Navi. Right? That like gets him ready for it. But Shmuel's life. This is Shmuel's life. And at some point I realized in my head, right, that I started to be able to wrap my head around how you could have a Kadosh figure who is in this weird status of representing truth and spirituality, but is also embedded into the political system, right? When I thought Lord of the Rings and I thought Gandalf, okay, let's take a break for a moment and let's look at a clip, okay? Here, open it, right? And let me show you, right? I want you now to close your eyes for a minute, right? I want you to close your eyes for a minute, and I want you to imagine Gandalf and think of Shmuel and everything we've just said, okay? And I want... So, 1 second. And I want you to think of one more scene in Tanakh, okay? Critical to the success of the Melech, once we've established this role of Navi, what is critical to the success of Melech in Shmuel? For a king to be successful, what does he need to do? He needs to listen to the Navi. He needs to listen to the Navi. Right? Shaul fails twice. Right? What is the first failure that Shaul does? Right? We already said in Perek Yud Gimel. In Perek Yud Gimel, what happens? What's the first failure of, if you have a Tanakh, right? You can look at it, Perek Yud Gimel. What's the first failure of Shaul? When does he fail?
He doesn't wait.
Right? The Navi coming is when the war really starts. Right? He doesn't wait. Okay? When he comes, the war will be successful. When the Navi comes... Very good. So I want to show you two scenes. Okay? And now I want you to imagine for a moment what a Navi actually looks like in Tanakh. Especially Shmuel. I want you to get the idea of Rosh Hashiva out of your head. I want you to get the idea of preacher out of your head. And I want you to think Gandalf for a second, okay? Two scenes. One is pull up, right? Gandalf's arrival at, I think it's Helm's Deep, right? Gandalf's charge. What? And when you look at this scene, I want you, guys, again, I want you to remember, think Navi as representative of truth, as the ultimate enemy of evil, as warrior, as politician, as support to the king. I want you to think about all this, okay? And I want you to, right, get your head out of whatever you thought, right, about rabbinic Navi figure. How's it going there, Sean? The internet is not so good.
Yes.
While we're waiting to set up, I want you to look at source 4 here. And I want you to also remember, right, if anyone who knows the whole movie of and the books of Lord of the Rings, in what sense Shmuel, we'll get to Shmuel in a second, right? How does Gandalf become the person that is really accepted across the different parts of society such that he is can be responsible and trusted to get these political movements going? What does he do?
He lived for centuries.
What? What does he do?
Be sort of the vine and live for centuries.
He what?
Be sort of the vine and live for centuries.
So that's not actually what he does. What does he do?
What does he do to what? To gain people's trust?
To gain their trust, to get involved in that. What does he do? He doesn't hang out in one place. What does he do?
He's an advisor.
No, before he gets to that point, what does he do? How does he gain people's trust? He goes around constantly, right? Meeting people. Yes, he does some miracles and stuff like that. But he's... Look, if you want to see Shmuel in this type of role, look at source 4. Okay, this is from Berak Zion of Shmuel. Vayishpot Shmuel et Yisrael kol yimei chayav. Shmuel judged his whole life. What does it look like? Vahalach midei shana b'shana v'savav beit el v'agilgal v'al mitzpah v'shafat Yisrael el et kol yimei kol moda eila. Every year he goes around and he judges everywhere. Utshuvato Ramata, Kisham Beito, Visham Shafat Yisrael, Vayiven Sham Mizbeach Ladonai, and then he would come back to Ramah, which is where he lives, and he would build a Mizbeach. And then, if you don't believe me that Shmuel is a quasi king, look at how he's described. Vayhi Kasher Zaken Shmuel, Vayasam Ed Banav, Shoftim Li Yisrael. As soon as he gets old, what does he do? He appoints a dynasty. He sets his kids up as Shoftim. Vayishem Ben Abba Chor Yoel, Vashem Mishneu Aviyah, Shoftim Biver Shava. But they're also not honest. And all the sages come against Shmuel. What do they say? Because your sons weren't worthy, we need a king. And this is bad to Shmuel. So what does he say? Right? He says, don't be angry. It's not you that they rejected as king. It's me. It's very clear that Shmuel is perceived as this quasi-king figure. Right, you definitely have this this very, very clear Shmuel as quasi king. Right, figure where that line is very, very unclear, because he's not just a prophet. The prophet are the people responsible for politics. That's what they're doing, and therefore they are spiritual leaders, but they're also in many ways these quasi kings. Yeah, take it away. Does it work? Okay, now, in that scene, if you look at that scene and think of Gandalf at that moment as Shmuel, do you start to get a better idea of what Navi looks like, right?
Yeah.
Here, right? So, responsible for politics. He is responsible. Now, we can go through Shmuel, but what is Shmuel's job in the first two rounds? Because remember, Shaul doesn't get, they don't agree that he's going to be a king so fast. What happens? Right, first they want to make him a king, and then what happens? People are like, some people go with him. Then what does he do? He wins a battle. So then? Right, so now Shmuel comes back. Where do the people go? And this, if you open to Shmuel, after the people decide that Shmuel is going to be king, who do they go to? That Shaul should be king. Who do they go to? Who should they go to? Shaul. Who do they actually go to?
Shmuel.
And this is what he does. He's in charge of the politics. He's in charge of making sure that the king right? Gets his armies. And this is what he does. Okay. Now, if you look at the psukim I gave you, right? Right, this is what he... Let me now tell you a little bit more of a story, okay? So, Shmuel convinces the people to... First, he's the kingmaker, right? Look at source 5 here. V'adonai gilad ozen Shmuel yom echad lefnei bosha ulei mor kait machar eshlach yelecha ish me'eretz binyamin u'mashach lo nagir al ami Yisrael v'oshir ami miyad plishtim gereidi rami kivad zakato elai. Right, first of all, God reveals himself to Shmuel, and he says, look, tomorrow someone's coming, I want you to make him king. V'ikach Shmuel epach Hashem, and v'itzok ha'resha v'yishakehu, v'yom rilingo v'ashcha Adonai al nachlato l'nagid. And not only does he make them king, but his job is to convince people that he should be king, right? So look at source 6 here, from Perek Yud Aleph in Shmuel. Vahimi macharat, vayasam shol ha'am, shlosha rashim, vayvo b'toch ha'machaneh, b'shmor et ha'boker, vayaku et amon, ad chom ha'yom, vayini sharim, vayafotsu, vili nisharu v'am shnayim yarchat. Vayomer amo Shmuel, mi omer sholim loch aleinu, tnu an ha'shim unim mitaim. Right, what happens? Shmuel wins the battle, and what do they say? Who said Shaul shouldn't be king? Let's kill him. But who they say that to? Shmuel. Right? Because Shmuel is still involved. No, today we won't. Instead, let's accept him. Today was a day of happiness. Let's go and let's make him king again. His job is also, though, to not just make kings and fight battles. What else does he do? So he gives Musar, but what else does he do? He removes kings. Okay? He removes kings. Right, so look at 7. This is Perek Yud Gimel. Vayochel shivat yamim lamoed asher Shmuel. V'lo ba Shmuel Gilgal v'yatza tzamelav. So Shmuel was supposed to wait 7 days. Remember, right, when Aragorn looks up and remembers that Gandalf had said on the third day whatever it was, right? Here it's the seventh day. On the fifth, right, the first light. Vayomer Shaul. And Shmuel... Right, Shaul panics. The people are leaving, so he tells them, "Hagishu elayo la vashlamim vayal olah." Bring me karbanot. And as he's finishing, what happens? Vayika chalotu la aloda olav yini Shmuel ba veitzei Shaul likrato levaracho. As he's finishing, Shmuel comes to give him a bracha. Vayomer Shmuel, "Masita, what did you do?" Vayomer Shmuel, "Kireiti kinefatz amel lai vatalo vati lmoere yamim flishtim nesavim mechras." What's your problem? I did what you asked. The people were leaving. I had to do something. So what does he tell them? What does Shmuel tell him? Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayomer Shmuel al Shaul, "Niskalta lo shamarta et mitzvot anei lecha asher tzivach ki ata hechen adonai mamlacha ve Yisrael alam." That's it. You're not getting a dynasty. He doesn't lose his kingship yet, but he's not going to have a dynasty. And then after the Amalek case, what happens? Right, then he strips him of the melucha entirely. Okay, remember this? Now I want to tell you another story from Shmuel. What happens after Shmuel's melucha is stripped from him? What begins to happen?
The descent of paranoia.
Descent into madness because of paranoia. Why? Why?
Because he's going to attach to it and doesn't want to get it out.
Oh, it is so much worse than that. And this I owe to my dear friend, to Rabbi Goldstein. And he says, no. The paranoia runs much deeper than that. In what perek in Shmuel is Shmuel's paranoia most evident? What? Shaul, rather. Machar Chodesh. The Haftarah of Machar Chodesh. Good. Someone remind me of this wonderful story. What happens? Anyone remember the Haftarah of Machar Chodesh? What happens? What? Okay, Gavi, go.
David is, I'm sure,
if Shaul is going to kill him or not, so he hides in the field for 3 days, and Yohanan is at the... What? Is that the... It's 2 days.
Come on, tell me the basic story, come on.
Shaul gets angry that David isn't there. And starts threatening that he's gonna kill David because he thinks David is plotting against him.
Good.
And then Yohanan goes with the servant and fires the arrows and says, that there's the other way, and that's the signal, and he
doesn't hide. Very good. And what does Shaul start to do to Yonatan at different points in this story? He yells at him, he screams at him. What does he eventually try to do? Kill him, right? Accidentally kill him with a spear. And what else does Shaul do randomly? What does he turns to his servants at different points, and what does he say to them? What are you doing? Right, you're rebelling against me. Every little thing, he's constantly paranoid. He goes into madness. In fact, the Tanakh actually says, right, he descends into madness. Right? Look at source 10. This is Perek Yutet and Shmuel. Vatihi ruach Adonai ra'ah el Shaul, vahi bevato yoshev, hu yoshev, vato yoshev, v'chanito biyado, v'david minagein biyad. Right? He's playing music, and what happens? Vaygesh Shaul b'chanit b'David v'akir v'iftar m'menu Shaul v'yach chanit b'akir v'David nas v'melait b'laylahu. Right, he tries to kill him, or he tries to stab him with a sword, and then he tries to do the same thing to Yonatan in number 11. Vayan Yonatan Shaul aviv v'yomrei lav lama yomar ma'asa. Right, David Yonatan tries to defend David, and what does he say to him? Vayet Shaul chanit alav lakoto v'yinei yonatik chalom me'am aviv lamir David. Why is he so paranoid? And what else? His paranoia, by the way, leads to crazy things. It doesn't just lead to him killing his own son. What is it, or trying to kill his own son? What else does he do? Very good. Right, in the most dramatic moment, what happens? David runs away. He's starving. He ends up at Nov Irakoanim. They give him some food. Right? They give him a sword. We'll come back to this. Right? And what happens? Shaul hears from Doeg that Evyatar, the Kohen, they're plotting against him because they gave food to David. Right? They gave him a sword. And he massacres the whole city. What? He massacres the whole city of Nov Irakoanim. Amazingly, how many times in Tanakh does God say that the reason that he is going to take away Shaul's kingship is because he murdered a whole city? How many times?
Zero.
Why not?
Because that decision was already made.
Sure, but why he's not even called out for it, ever. Why? Because he's going insane. Why is he going insane?
He has horrible advisors.
So this I never really thought of enough. Here's why he's going insane. Because he is caught in a terrible, terrible catch-22. Why? And now I want you to understand Shaul's insanity. Who's trying to rebel against him?
No one.
That's not true. Someone is very much trying to rebel against him at God's sanction. But who's trying to be king?
David.
Very good. That's a coup. Religiously sanctioned or not, it's a coup. Fine. It's a coup. Okay? It is. Someone else wants to be king, intends on becoming king. Okay? Religiously sanctioned, that's not my point. He deserves to be king. But no, it's so much worse than that.
His only legitimacy for being king is the same thing he's
No! It's even worse than that. And this is what I never thought of, but it's so obvious. Because if David does not become king, and Shaul stays king, then who becomes king? Yonatan, he's the crown prince. What happens when the crown prince pledges allegiance to the rebel? What happens? What? David would become king automatically, no matter what happens. Which means that already, right, and you find this throughout Shmuel is constantly accusing his own men of being traitors. Why? Because of course, no! Because of course they're going to betray him. Because no matter what happens, if Shaul remains king, Yonatan will be the crown prince, and he'll give over the Malchut to David. If David wins in the coup, David becomes Melech. Which means there is literally no reason for anybody to be loyal to him, because the next administration, one way or the other, will be David. There is nothing you can do. But he can't kill his son, because his son is the crown prince. If he wants to maintain his kingship, his son represents it. So he can't do anything. He's stuck. Right? He's going mad. Because of course he's going mad. Because even if people legitimately say that they are loyal to Shaul, that means they're loyal to Shaul's dynasty. Except Shaul's dynasty already declared allegiance to David. Right? Right? There's no way he can win. Of course you're going to go insane. So God never accuses him of killing Novi Arkoanim. Because it was the previous things that got Shaul to the point where he was. Right? But by this point, because Shaul wasn't able to act as a king, and he constantly, right, he always, whatever, you know, at that moment he wanted to do, he ended up, right, all those things. But by this point, God can't blame him, because you hear that David went to Novi Arkoanim and they gave him food, right? Now, you might say, oh, Novi Arkoanim, how should they know? He's the general of David, right? What happens in the story of Novi Arkoanim? Right? Let's read the story for a second, and you tell me if you would be paranoid in this story, okay? You're Shaul for a minute. Let's see if you're paranoid. So in Perek Chof Aleph in Shmuel, here's the story. Okay? Vayavo, this is Perek Chof Aleph, Pasuk Bet. Vayavo David Noved, Elachimelech Kohen, Vecharech Melech Grad David, Vayomer Lo Maduata Levadecha, V'ishen Itach, he comes, and Ahimelech looks at him and he said, why are you alone? Why is that weird? He's the general. How often do you send the chief of staff sneaking around? And it's not just sneaking around. What happens? He comes. The king told me not to tell anybody. I'm going to a secret place. Do you have any bread? Now, the king sends his general, his chief of staff, on a top secret mission without bread. How many people right now are suddenly like, something smells fishy? Right? Raise your hand. Right? Okay, good. It gets worse. Remember, he's on a secret mission as a warrior. So first, and remember, this is not a place where people come for food. How do I know this is not a normal place to come for food? Because the next food is Vayana Kohen David Vayomer Ein Lechem Chol Al Tachad Yadi. What? The king sent you without food and you came here. There is literally no food here that non-Kohenim can eat. So the general is on a secret mission from the king, and the king doesn't pack him lunch, and he ends up in a city that has no food. Okay? This is the story that you're supposed to believe. And then, what else do you think you might have if you're on a top secret mission as part of the CIA? A weapon. Very good. The general shows up with no food, right? In a city with no food. And he says, so what's his explanation? He's like, well, I haven't been... I haven't been with women in the last few days, so I'm not tummy. I'll take bread. You know, tahor bread. Not much I can do. He's like, okay. He gives him Kodesh bread. And then he says, Vayomer David, Lachimach v'en yesh bo tachat yadcha chanit o cherev. Remember, he's in a town only of Kohanim. They don't even have non-Kadosh food. It's only Kohanim. And he says, do you have a weapon, perchance? Okay, again, right? This is a bit of a questionable scene, right? Right? And he says, yeah, I got one. I got one sword for you. It's the one that you used to kill Goliath. That's all I got. It's like very symbolic sword, but we don't really carry weapons. I happen to have that one. And David's like, sounds good to me. Right, that's about now. This story. How many of you at this point, if Shaul hears this story, are going to believe, how many of you believe that they weren't siding with David? Okay, but how many of you think that they weren't suspicious that something might be going on? When you read the story carefully, how many of you actually believe that the Kohanim in Nov didn't know that something was wrong? They might not know what's wrong, but how many of you actually believe that? You don't. So when Shaul is paranoid out of his mind, because of course he is, because he knows that he's not supposed to be king anymore. Shmuel already decided that. And the crown prince had put him in a catch-22. So anyone who wants a position in the next administration has to pledge allegiance to David. Because whether Yonatan becomes king or David becomes king, David becomes king. There's literally no way out of this. Of course he's paranoid. And then he hears that David shows up in a city and just says, well, there was no food, right? And they give him food and the sword he used to kill Goliath, which, when he used that sword, people, who was supposed to kill Goliath? Shaul. David was a young upstart, right? This sword is symbolic. Remember, this is the sword that he performed the act in battle that made him Zoche to what? Marry the princess. Become to the heir to the throne. He married Michal because of this. No, it's for this. He was promised Michal because he killed Goliath.
Oh, yeah.
That's the symbolic sword. You wouldn't be paranoid. You wouldn't. He shouldn't have killed them. But you blame him? Of course he's paranoid out of his mind. Right? Now, do me a favor, Sean. Pull up the scene where Gandalf first comes to Denethor. Now, let me set the scene in The Lord of the Rings, and I want you to think for a moment, okay? Denethor in The Lord of the Rings is the steward of the House of Gondor. Right? He's the steward of the House of Gondor. That means that he's the acting king. But who's actually supposed to be king? Aragorn, who's the heir of? What? Isildur, guys. Come on, Isildur. Right? No, it's okay. I don't care if you don't have Bakias in Lord of the Rings. You just should. Okay. He's Isildur's heir. Guys. He's Isildur's heir. Okay? Very good. Now. So, guys. So, think about it for a moment. Okay? You're in the exact same situation. Denethor is like Shaul. He's the acting king. But what does he know already? That Gandalf, remember we already established he's basically the Navi figure. What has he decided? That the true king is going to return. And there's a slight fact that you might remember from The Lord of the Rings that makes it worse. Because who ends up pledging allegiance to Aragorn? His son, Faramir. Right? Now, there's other things going on in this story, right? But do you think you might be paranoid at this point? Do you think you might take out that wrath on your son at this point? You might. You might just do that. So there's two scenes, if we can get this open, that I want you to look at. Okay, so in this scene, what I want to highlight a few things. Do you see what it looks like for a king who knows that it's already been decided that, or not in this case, a steward, right? That he's the acting king, but his power is in truth been stripped of him. Do you see? What do you see? You see the madness that begins to take him over? And you also see in this scene the dynamic where if I asked you at that moment, who is more powerful, the king, right? Or the wizard, or Lidugma, the king, or the Navi? Who is more powerful? It's not clear, right? That's exactly the dynamic I want you to understand. Because remember, Shmuel on the one hand makes kings, and he strips them their power. But when God tells him, take the power away from Shaul, what does he say? Shaul will kill me. Because the dynamic is complicated. The Navi isn't actually king, right? The king is more powerful. He, on the one hand, can make him king, but on the other hand, right, he's not king, and if people are loyal to the king, so then... Right? If they're loyal to the king, then what's going to happen? They're not going to respect the authority of the Navi, right? There's this complex relationship. It's not clear in that moment who is more powerful, right? Gandalf is insisting, you're not the real king. You don't have the right. You have a right. You have an achrayit. You're just a steward, right? But he's the acting king, right? Shaul... There's this fascinating thing that if you read the story of Shaul, it sounds like Shaul is king for years and years and years. How many years does Chazal say? How many years does Tanakh say he's king? Two. He's not king for 2 years. He's king for years. Right? It's clear. So why do they say he's king for 2 years? Because after 2 years, he's officially stripped of his power. But he's the acting king for years. He's just not the legitimate king anymore. Right? But he's the acting king. He's the acting king, and you see there's this weird dynamic. In this scene, you don't know who's more powerful. Right? It's not clear at that moment. If you want to see what a descendant of madness looks like, with the combination of enemies on your door, and your son rebelling against you, and having pledged authority. So, this is a little bit more dramatic, maybe more dramatic than Shaul's story, though to be fair, I'm not even sure it is. But it's a very good illustration of what that type of descendant to madness might look like. So I will point out, you see in this scene, right? If your son has rebelled against you, you're in a catch-22, and you have enemies surrounding you at all times, right? Yeah. You're going to be paranoid. And in this case, that paranoia leads him to kill himself. But guess who else stabs himself with a sword because he's been in this battle against a coup and suddenly is surrounded by enemies, and his biggest fear is to actually face the enemies and be humiliated by them and rather kill himself than do that. Guess who else does that? Oh, Shaul! Shaul begs that they throw him, that he's right here, right? What does he do? He has his soldiers surround him and to set him on fire. What does Shaul do? He turns to his weapon bearer and says, kill me! I'd rather die at your hands than the enemies humiliate me. Right? Because he's been driven to madness. And he doesn't want to be humiliated by the enemy. He'd rather die. He'd rather kill himself in glory. Right? If you want to understand what this looks like, that this drive to madness, the combination of enemies and a coup and your son siding, right? The crown prince siding with his son and the madness that leads you to and willing to kill yourself and willing to kill your son, right? That's a very good scene of what that type of emotional turmoil, which is pshat in Shmuel. This is pshat in Shmuel. That is, he, of course he goes insane. What do you think is going to happen? Right? God makes him go crazy. Now, David. Let's talk about David for a minute. Okay? David starts off his career and his greatness emerges from military success. Okay? Now David, for all we think of him as the singer of songs, right? He's a military leader. That's what he is. And Tanakh does not look askance on that. It valorizes it. It valorizes it. Okay? In source 14, I gave you, what do the women say? What is the song that the women sing? Okay, right? This is their great song, right? That Shaul kills thousands, but David kills tens of thousands. Now, you and me, we think about this like, oh, that's a great song, right? But if you realize you're fighting enemies and military is necessary, valor is something you look up to. Now, do we have time, right? there's this wonderful scene. It doesn't appear in the book, but it does in the movie, right? Where it's not Dafka, not about Aragorn. There's a contest between Legolas and Gimli, right? And what do they do? Yes, they have this wonderful scene of the kill count. And then in its final moment, what happens?
Legolas kills
the elephant. Yes, thank you. Legolas jumps on the elephant, right, and shoots arrows down at this elephant until it falls. And he gets down, he falls down. And what's the first thing Gimli says to him? Yes, that only counts as one, right? Right, it's a beautiful scene. But I want you to understand, that's what a military life looks like, right? It's... You're fighting it. There needs to be a little of that competition because that's what drives a life like this. And that's right. That, in many ways, is David. Now, I will point out, if Shaul, in a certain sense, of this, I think, is already a little bit too dramatic. But by the way, Shaul is also like this. We already saw my favorite scene in Lord of the Rings, which when that's how I imagine Shaul, by the way, from now on, right? Is Shaul as Gandalf coming to Helm's Deep? The truth is that Agog is more than that. Agog is really the symbol of all evil. So if you want to think about it, think more Gandalf against the Balrog, right? Except I'm not sure Agog really looked like that, right? Right? But that is the battle of like good and evil. But let's go back to David, okay? Now, I want you to understand how much military strength is part of his greatness. The story we just read. Okay? So first of all, there's the yes, he's killing 10,000 other people. But undeniably, what is the moment that captures everybody's imagination of David as the great warrior? Goliath. 100%. Right? He's a young kid. He comes. Nobody believes in him. Nobody believes in him. Yeah? He comes and he battles Goliath. So what happens in the story? His brothers say, you can't do it. He says, of course I can. I have God with me, right? And I was a shepherd. And whenever I used to have wolves come, I would fight them off to protect my lambs. Right? This is his backstory. This is David's first military victory. Now, as we said, at what point is David's ability to be king most challenged? We just read the story. When is it? We just read it. When he's fleeing from Shaul with no food, nothing, no weapon, right? That's when you look at him and you say, are you really, right? Are you king? And what turns the tide for him? Right? We already said this is the scene that leads Shaul to kill Nova Irakanim. What is the moment? He gets back that sword. He gives him, he said, I only have one sword, and it's the sword that represents everything you are about, that first moment when your greatness was evident. Okay? Put on the scene of Elrond bringing Anduril. Okay? Alright, I want you to think about this scene. I want you to understand what it means for someone to be, right, a king, and for there to be a single object that represents his power at a moment when he's most vulnerable, right? This scene, also one of my favorite scenes, right? But I want you to understand what a symbolic sword does. Here. What? I think you see in that scene, right? You see, he's broken. He tells him there's no hope. No hope. And then what does he do? He pulls out a symbolic sword and, right, all the confidence comes back. He's going to do the impossible. But you think about that. That's what a military king looks like, right? David is at his debt, right? Why do you think God made it that is the sword he picks up in Nov? Because he's at that brook. He has no food. I mean, he had a sword, but still he has no food. He's fighting a, right? He has no hope. So what happens? God puts the sword that represents his greatness, the source of his greatness, the victory of Goliath, puts it there, right? And suddenly, this is the tide. The tide begins to turn. And again, if you understand, why is Shaul so angry? Why does he think that Nova are rebelling? Because they didn't give him a sword. They gave him that sword, right? They gave him that sword, right? Right? Put aside the ranger, become the king you were born to be. That is not what you want someone to be telling your rebel general, right? Okay, he didn't actually say it, but you know what I mean, right? Right? Yes, yes, Adam. No, he used the slingshot to knock him out, and then he took Goliath's sword from him and killed him. Right? He took Goliath's sword and chopped his head off. He knocked him out. Maybe he was dead, maybe he was unconscious, but then he runs down and he takes Goliath's sword and he cuts off Goliath's head with that sword. It's Goliath's sword. Right? This is a massive sword. Right? Now, David is, again, David is this interesting personality. On the one hand, you see, he's a victory man, right? We can go through, you saw already in the first scene, right? He's running down fearlessly, inspiring others, right, to fight against all odds, right? He's a military man. He's killing, you know, thousands of orcs as he's running, right? Like, that's what, David isn't killing orcs, but, you know, fine, right? But at the same time, what is, yeah? He killed him, whatever he did, meaning he cuts off his head with Goliath's sword. Right? That's the symbolic act. Right? Meaning, put it this way. Okay, I'll put it slightly differently. Right? I'll put it slightly differently. Even if Goliath was already dead, the Plishtim, the war isn't won because the Plishtim don't know he's dead and not unconscious until he cuts off his head. Meaning, the act of victory is cutting off his head with Goliath's sword. Okay. Now, if you want to, but what's weird about David is that somehow we believe that he's, on the one hand, this amazing warrior. That's who he is, right? He's killing tens of thousands of people. That's part of his valor. And yet, he's at the same time this spiritual singer, right? And it's a little bit hard to swallow that it's in the same person. But if you want a very good scene, right, that shows you how the same person we just saw as this warrior is also, and it doesn't even feel weird, a spiritual singer. And at the same time, you want to see what it means for the Navi / wizard, right, to grant legitimacy to the king, right? It's wrapped up in one scene. You want to put the coronation of Aragorn? So you see a lot of the themes wrapped up here, right? You see that the role of the wizard / Navi, right, is to be the kingmaker. One line that you never thought you'd hear. But you also see, right, that here it seems natural, right, that he becomes king, and what does he do? He starts singing in Elvish, in which is the ancient spiritual language, essentially, of Lord of the Rings, of Middle Earth. But it's not contradictory, right? Meaning, it actually makes sense. Right, he's invested his life in fighting evil, right? But he also, so he has a spiritual side. Those aren't contradictory, right? Maybe in the modern world they are, but it actually makes sense. Now, at the end, you also see, right, his, you know, willing to humble himself before non-kings, which, to be fair, is also part of David's story, as opposed to Shaul, right? I mean, that's David's interaction with Michal, when Michal sees him dancing before the Aron, right, where she says, what are you doing? You're a king. You don't, right, you don't humiliate yourself. And he says, no, right, that's your father. That's why your father isn't king anymore, right? I understand that it's my pride to, right, to celebrate with God, even if that means I debase myself in front of people, right? He doesn't have that, he's not on that, that is part of David's personality. Now, one of the interesting things about Melachim is that once you have David, and you establish, what is unique about the Davidic line that's not true of Shaul's line? It lasts forever, even when they don't deserve it. Right? It lasts forever. And that means that people become king whether or not they deserve it. And the only thing that matters is the inherent sanctity of the line. Right? So you get this very strikingly in Melachim Bet. Now we're skipping from Melachim to a minute. Source 16, in this very dramatic story of the boy king. Right? The boy king. What's the boy king? So what happened was, Ataliah Right, what? It's the boy king of Yoram. What? What? Yes, crazy lady. Thank you. Right, so Ataliah is the mother of Ahaziah. So what does she do? Ataliah ben Ahaziah, Ra'ata, ki meit ben avatak v'demeit kol zera mamlacha. So what does she do? She kills all the kings, so she wants to be queen. So what? But what happens? And this is fascinating. What happens? Vatikach Yosheva baramelch Yoram achor Ahaziah et Yoash ben Ahaziah vatignov oto mitoch bnei hamelech hamumatim oto v'etminikto b'chadar mitod v'istiru oto b'nei Ataliah v'lo mat. So what do? They hide Yoram where? Beis Hamikdash. And Yoram is a little kid. Vayhi ata beit Adonai mitchabei sheishon v'Ataliah molech al haaretz. So he hides there for 6 years. Vashana shvit shalach Yehoyada v'ikach etzarei hameyot l'kariv l'aratzim v'yevei otam ilav beit Adonai v'chrot lehem brit v'yishbe otam beit Adonai v'yarem oto et ben hamelech. And they wait 6 years and they pull out this young king and they say, ha, we have the king, right? And they say, "Vaytzavim leimorza davar shir tasun hashlishim again by a Shabbat v'shem mishmer ben Hamelech v'shlishit b'shar asur v'shlishit b'shar acher aratzim u'shmardem mishmer abayit misach masach." I want you to divide into three groups. I want you to make sure that no one right take the different gates. U'shtei adot b'chem kol yotzei Shabbat v'shem mishmer ben anay Hamelech v'kavta Hamelech saviv ish v'chilav biyadal v'abalas derot yumat v'yu Hamelech v'tzedob v'o. Right, surround the king. Why? Because what are they going to do? They're going to anoint him as king. So they don't want anybody to, right? Yeah, to kill him. Right? So that's what they do. They surround him, and then you skip to Pasuk Yudbet. They anoint him, they say, long live the king. Right? And she hears what happens, and she runs, and she says, oh, it's a rebellion. Right? But you see that the conception in Tanakh of Malchut Beit David is, what's the only important thing? Your descendant of the line. That's it. It's inherently sanctified. Once God promises the Malucha, it never leaves. It doesn't matter, right? And therefore, everybody's involved in it. So much so, right? How do you, that you see it? They hide this little kid in the Beit HaMikdash, right? As a little kid, he said, can't be a king, but he has to be king, right? That's what it means to be a Davidic king. Now, you've probably, you know, if you have watched the movie, you know this comes up a lot. But you've already seen this several times, right? But for those of you who haven't watched the whole movie, right at the beginning, right? Maybe you want to pull up. It's part of it, right? In the second part of the Council of Elrond, right? When Boromir finds out who Aragorn is. Right, what happens? Anyone remember the scene?
It was there while they were deciding fellowship.
Yes, it's the second half of the Council of Elrond. Right? So what happens? Boromir says, and who are you that I should listen to as a ranger of the north? And what does Legolas say? This is no mere ranger. It's Aragorn, son of Arathorn, Isildur's heir, and you owe him your allegiance. I'm not sure if that's an exact quote. My quotes of Gemara are better than Lord of the Rings. But, you know, I care more about exact formulations. But something like that. Right? And Boromir says, Sildur's heir, right? Gondor has no king. Gondor needs no king. Right? But there is this notion, right, that no matter how many generations has passed, since Isildur, right? There's only one legitimate kingdom. And the descendant, no matter how many generations it's been, there's like a Kedusha in the Malchus, right? But that's the way the Torah describes Malchut Beit David. It just is, right? Parenthetically, where is he kept safe? What? So Yoram is kept safe in the Kodesh Kedashim. It happens to be that where is Aragorn kept safe? In Rivendell. Right, in Rivendell, right, which, right, sort of makes sense, right? That's, right. But I want you to understand that part of, you have to understand about Tanakh is we're not used to this, right? We're not used to really thinking what it means to have a divinely sanctioned dynastic order. But what it means is that even if it's a little kid, no matter how many generations since that person's been acting king, it's kadosh. It's inherently kadosh. And as you see here, right? You know, if you watch the movie, you'll see they'll say, we've heard the king has a healing hand, right? The days of the king, there will be peace. Right? There's this notion that you wait the way we wait for Mashiach, right? Like, there's this notion that when the king is back, everything will be right. Because God, that's part of God's promise. That's part of the inherent nature of an internal malchus. So, what I want you to think of, and we can do some more examples if you want. It's getting late, so if you want to stop, we can. But you should probably bring out the sushi and let
bring out the sushi and keep going for a little bit longer.
But let me. So far, what we've seen, I want you to understand, guys, and you can tell me honestly whether this is helpful. But I want you to understand that I think, you know, and this is how he said it to the people in Toronto also, is that I think sometimes we really have a hard time imagining, like, a world that is so different from our own, where a Navi, who we think of as like a rabbi, a person who speaks the word of God, no. At least in Shmuel and Malachim, the role, definitely in Shmuel, the role of the Navi is, he's involved in politics, he anoints kings, he tells kings when they don't deserve to be king anymore. He fights wars. He inspires wars, right? He is God's hand in politics. And therefore, Shmuel, you could, right, can go and kill Aragorn and slice him into Aragorn. Oh my God, I'm so Agag. Oh God, now it's late. He kills Agag. He quarters him, right? But you see here, it's actually right. The way I imagine Shmuel, if you really want to understand someone who, yeah, he represents something larger and spiritual, but the way he does that, he's fundamentally responsible for kings. He's responsible for telling kings off, for anointing them, for making sure that evil is fought, right? That he's out there going around talking to people, and when necessary, he pick up a weapon, right, and fight the symbol of evil. Right? That's the scene, right, of Gandalf at Helm's Deep, where I think, yeah, that, I mean, he basically looks like an old rabbi, except on a horse with a weapon, right? Which is, to us, totally strange. But when you see in the movie, suddenly you think, wait, there is another model that exists. It's not the one we're used to, because we don't live in a world of Nivi, and we don't live in a world where the military is like that. But if you want to get your head into Tanakh, I want you to think of a Navi as a guy riding around on a horse, right? Pushing a religious political agenda and fighting evil and pushing the king to fight evil. Remember, he's with Shaul at the right at the war against Amalek. Right? He's there. Right? Just like here, it doesn't surprise you. It's not weird that Gandalf is at Helm's Deep or he's at the Black Gate, which we didn't do, but whatever. Right? He's there because of course he is. That's his responsibility. And you think of a king, right? Where the dynamic between the king and the Navi is very strange. Because on the one hand, the king is more powerful. But on the other hand, the Navi is more powerful. And there's a weird dynamic. And you saw that in the Denethor scene. Where, on the one hand, he's telling him, you're not king anymore. Right? You owe your allegiance to somebody else. But it's not like he does that and Denethor says, you're right, I'm leaving. Right? Because it's a weird dynamic. Just like with Shmuel, where Shmuel, yes, he appoints the kings. Just like you saw Aragorn appoints Aragorn. Gandalf appoints Aragorn. But you think about it. But he's also afraid to take on Shaul. Because, of course he is. Because it's not a clear dynamic. There's this weird power struggle. And if you want to understand why this book spends so much time talking about the madness of Shaul, and you realize, yeah, of course he's mad. Because there's the true king out there. The Navi, who appointed him, remember, right? Who used to be an ally of his, right? Appointed him. His own son has put him in a catch-22 because he's the crown prince, right? And now there's no such thing as showing allegiance to him. Because one way or the other, you know who the next king is going to be. You see what that means, right? You see the madness in Denethor, and you start seeing, oh, that's what it looks like for a king to go mad because he's stuck in this situation. And you think about David, and you think, how is it that on the one hand, clearly we valorize his battle? Well, the reason is because he's fighting evil, right? The Jews were constantly in mortal peril. So, of course, you're going to valorize a warrior. But he's also a spiritual leader. He's equally known for singing songs to God. That's not a contradiction. But when we read the book, we're always like, wait, he's a soldier. Oh, that's why he didn't build the Beit HaMikdash. Yeah, that's what David says. But not God never actually says it. There's nothing intrinsically contradictory to being a spiritual person and being a soldier. Right? You can have that exist in the same person. Right? And you know, how many people, when you read the scene of the Novi Rakonim and them giving him the sword which he chopped off Goliath's head, how many of you think the power of that moment, that, right, the way you see in this scene, he's running away from, it's hopeless, he's running away from Joel, he's no food, no weapons, right, he's fighting a war that seems impossible. And at the moment when he's, right, giving up, what happens, right, this spiritual leader essentially says, I got the sword, right? The sword that represents everything you're about. For David, obviously, it's the victory against Goliath. Here it's, right, the sword that represents his dynasty, right? If you want to understand the power of the moment when David, running away with nothing, no food, no nothing, is suddenly given the sword of Goliath, and that's the turning point, right? Look at that, where That's where he says, be the king you were born to be. It's when he's giving up, he's running away, and oh, he has the sword. It's like, no, right? I can do it. I brought down Goliath. Right? I took the place of Shaul in battle. And I think, at least for me, right? Because, you know, I've never been in the army, right? I grew up in America, right? Like, you know, I don't think in these terms, right? And to really get my head into what does it mean to have a warrior spiritual king? What does it mean for a spiritual leader to not just look like a Rosh Yeshiva, but be someone who, yes, has the word of God, but also runs around making sure that wars happen properly and the right king is in place, and when necessary will kill, right? And will be a warrior, right? That image is very hard in my head. I watched Lord of the Rings and it's not... Right, I can see it in Gandalf, and that's why I'm like, oh, this is, right, there is another world, right? The world of Tanakh is not the world I live in, right? Like I said, you know, I said it in jest, but again, right, none of us can imagine Reb Chaim Ozer going and, you know, right, getting on a horse or a tank or a mashiach, right, in front of the enemy. It's just not in our cheshbon, right? We just can't, right? Chaim's, you know, is just imagining it right now, him riding down in a horse, right? To be fair, in Gush, for anyone who knows that Rosh Yeshiva at Gush, I always do sort of imagine Rav Meidan, who's a Rosh Yeshiva and has like a long white beard, but also is known as a military warrior and quite reckless and always wears sneakers because of the time that he kicked a Chavetz Chashur that turned out to actually be a bomb and he's missing half his foot, right? So I already sort of imagine him as the Gandalf scene, but that's just my personal resonance. He sort of looks like, you can look at a picture, you'll see what I mean. He sort of looks that like Gandalf. But, you know, for me, I have found it, part of it is I really like The Lord of the Rings, but part of it is I really do think that there is a power to movies where we get lost in it. And we actually immerse ourselves in a world that's not our own. But I think that's helpful when learning Shmuel and Malachim, because the world is so not our own. Right? It's so different from the way we imagine it. And it takes a lot of imagination, a lot of creativity for us to immerse ourselves in that world. So I like using these clips because I do think, you can be honest with me, but how many people, when we watch some of these clips and try to integrate it, have a little bit, right, your imagination has been opened to try to get into what does it look like to have a court navi and having military king and what madness looks like when you're caught in a catch 22. How many people do these clips help sort of get into that? Okay? And like I said, I know it's a bit of a quirky sheer, right? And yeah, it's quirky because, look, I happen to like Lord of the Rings, right? But as I started with, I don't think it's accidental. I don't think, right, as Tolkien said, right, he looked back and he said, of course it was biblical, because, you know, if you're good at mythology and you're influenced by the Bible, right, he wrote a story that, as he said, is influenced by the Bible. Of course it is, right? Because a lot of these stories, and this is what I want you to think about as a broad broad summary point to this. And if you want, we can do some more points afterwards. But think of Tanakh, especially Shmuel Malachim, as an epic tale. Right? It's an epic. That's what it is, right? It's this saga of glory and valor and spirituality, all mixed up in one. That's what it is, right? It's a story. You're supposed to get lost in it. Okay. I do have one more for it, but this is really only going to be for the Lord of the Rings nerds that are going to appreciate this. Okay? But this is really a chiluk between the movie. But I told Sean I'd say it, so let me say it, okay? One of the biggest differences between the movie and the book is as follows, okay? In the book, in the movie, it ends on a high note, like you saw, right? Of course it does. Movies end on a high note. It does not end on a high note. And Saruman, who's like the evil wizard, not for now, right? Rebellious evil wizard, whatever, right? Is killed in this dramatic scene where he is stabbed and falls off a tower. Yeah, it falls onto the water wheel, which does not happen in the book at all. Right? What happens in the book, Sean? Right? He actually escaped, went back to the Shire, which is where the hobbits are from, and he's causing mayhem, and he's disguised, and he's right, basically ruined their life. So after all these happy things, and you know, they've risked their lives and destroyed Sauron, and etc., 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 they return to their Shire, and their life is in disarray, and they have to do it all over again. Right? And they have to cleanse the Shire. If that didn't mean anything to you, that's fine. No, there are obvious reasons why the movie ends on a high note and the book doesn't, right? Okay, fine. Or why the movie chose not to go that way with the book. But if you want, in a nutshell, the difference between Melachim and Divrei Hayamim, it would be this difference. Because Melachim and Divrei Hayamim, Divrei Hayamim is a historiographical retelling in the time of Bayit Sheni of much of the stories of Shmuel and Melachim. There are many differences between these books, but one of the main differences is that in Shmuel and Melachim, the stories are told as they happened. Okay? And often, when stories happen, bad things happen to good people, good things happen to bad people, because history has its course of events, and if your father was terrible, right, and you inherit the bad kingdom, bad things might happen in your time. And therefore, there are good kings, righteous kings, who have a lot of trouble with enemies, and there are terrible kings who, nevertheless, have really, really successful kingdoms. Okay? And this creates a lot of confusion for people in the time of Shmuel and Melachim, especially Melachim, because why are you trusting that the good kings are really good if things are always bad under the good kings? Right, and things are good under the bad kings. Like, why do you think you should avoid Avodah Zarah? And it's very hard to believe that you're doing the right thing when you're following the good kings, because life isn't good. In Divrei Hayamim, which is as I said, a historiographical retelling, where part of the message is there's Schar V'Onesh, and it's trying to talk about Malchut Yudah in the best light. These things are softened, and a lot of the good things that happen to bad kings are toned down, and a lot of the bad things that happen to good kings are toned down, and the good things are trumped up, right? Are trumped up. Good kings always have good things happen to them, because they're written at different times. Melachim is a record of what's happening at the time. Divrei Hayamim is a retelling when people have to look back on the story in the time of Bayit Sheni and have confidence in the notion of a Malchut Beit David. Right? And they have to have confidence that there is Schar V'Onesh in the world. So Divrei Hayamim tells a much more overly simplified version of the story that highlights good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people. Because you need that. And in many ways, for me, that's like, this scene is the difference for me. Okay, again, this is only for really Lord of the Rings nerds. But, right, is that the movie is very Divrei Hayamim, right? Like, you want, at the end of the day, the good people win and everything is good. And that's what you want to walk away with, which is very much how you read Divrei Hayamim. Good things happen to good people all the time. Good kings, everything's great. But the book is the way things are much more in Shmuel Melachim, which is, look, don't always expect that because things are good for you, because you're doing the right thing, then it's going to be good for you. That's just not the way the world works. Sometimes you're stuck in a bad situation because you're stuck in a bad situation. Right? Like, you're coming off of a war. You expect everything to be good. It doesn't just turn, right? Doesn't, right? People coming out from World War II didn't come back. Oh, everything's okay. That's not how things work, even if you fought on the right side. So that's like my vort on the difference between the movie and the book. But it's also, you'll see, you know, if you read Malachim versus Dirayim, you'll see a similar phenomenon. And you have to think about why that is. But again, big adol. My point in this year is to try, less to give you chidushim on the book. Right? Even though I think we did talk about some chidushim on the book of Shmuel Malachim, but it's to get your head in the book. Right? It's to get you to imagine a world that's different than your own, so that you can really understand what these people are, what their personalities are like. What does it mean to be a Navi in this time period, a court Navi? What does it mean to be a Melech who's both a, you know, a soldier who they celebrate his kill count, but they can also write to Tehillim? Right? These are pictures we're not used to. But I think that it's valuable to use the power of cinema, right? To use our movies, which try to get us lost in the world, to for a moment get us lost in the world so that we can enter the world of Tanakh and maybe actually try to experience it the way the people living in that time, when it wasn't contradictory to their experience, would have felt it, right? And feel that about Shmuel. And also, and this is what I'll end with, one of the things that a lot of modern Zionists and religious Zionists have talked about is that the return to Israel, right, and the return of having a Jewish army has made it that for many people, the heroes that they begin to identify are not only the heroes, the traditional heroes of the Gemara and of, like, you know, the Rishonim and the Achronim, but they, right, who are the heroes of the secular Zionists and, to be fair, the religious Zionists? It's not really Bar Kokhba, it's Tanakh, right? The names that are popular among secular Israelis, a lot of them are just from Tanakh. Barak, right? Ehud, right? Gidon. Because the world of Galut, really, where we were a minority, really, of course, the heroes of Tanakh was hard to identify with. But one of the interesting things is that once you have a state, right, suddenly, in Israel, it's much, right, I figured if I give this cheer to Israelis, I mean, they might enjoy, I don't know, Lord of the Rings is popular everywhere, right? It was, you know, I know many Israelis who do enjoy it, but they don't see a contradiction between a rabbi and a soldier, because they've lived it. And I think that part of the fact that it's no longer a contradiction in terms, and that for a lot of people, when you think of Israeli rabbis, suddenly you know, Rav Goren, the picture people have in his head of it is him in military, right, is in military uniform blowing the shofar at the Kotel. And if you read his life story, you find out that at some point someone came to him and said, I had a dream that I had to write a Sefer Torah and give it to you so that you would read it on Har Sinai. And he said, that sounds great. And he found the mountain that he thought was Har Sinai and illegally went up and got a platoon and went up illegally to the top of what he thought was Har Sinai and read the Torah up there, right? Like, you read rabbis where you're like, yeah, I can sort of see you getting on a horse and, right, and fighting the enemy. Because when you have a state, it's where these lines are less distinct, right? The idea that we have is a lot because we didn't grow up that way, right? And therefore, some of Tanakh, even a modern Israeli, right, is never going to have this experience, obviously, right? And it takes a lot of imagination to get into it. But certain aspects of this, which for us, I think, are hard to get wrap our heads around, right? For my Israeli friends, if I said, "Can you imagine a Rosh Hashiva who's, right, who's going to go and kill the enemy?" They'll all be like, "Yes, him, 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 and him," right? So I think it's worth recognizing that on the one hand, yes, there are certain things that it takes a lot of imagination for any of us to get in there. But on the other hand, it's worth remembering that some of the reason that we can't really understand some of these things, and it takes an exercise for us to think about how there's not a contradiction between being a brave soldier, and that's something that you should actually valorize, and that same person being a Talmud Chacham and a, right, and a spiritual figure and fundamentally peaceful. That's because we grew up in America. But here, where you need a state, when you have a state, right, you're forced into these positions that maybe we weren't in growing up in America. Okay, so that's just a point that I think is Chomer LaMachshava, It's just something to think about, to realize that these more hybrids that for us sound funny because we say, oh, Rav Chaim Ozer, right? Do we imagine him killing an enemy? But when you say the same thing to me about, you know, Rav Meidan, right? No, I know he literally, I know he did that, right? And so one of the reasons I think it's beneficial to try to stretch your imagination and get into the world of Tanakh is because while some of the things we don't live, some of the things in modern Israel we're back to living. Right, and things like that hybrid model, where it's not a contradiction to be a warrior and be a spiritual leader, that's something that we should value and realize that that's not just time of Tanakh, that's reality. But as Americans who didn't grow up with it, it takes a little bit of stretching, right? A little bit of imagination. So movies might help, but on that point, it might also help to look around at your Israeli counterparts and imagine a world that's different than the one you grew up with. Okay, those are my thoughts. I think we'll stop for tonight. It's 11:45 and you have sushi. But I hope this